Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Sociology, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Christina Millar, one of the hosts of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Dr. Joseph O. Baker about his new book, co-authored with Christopher Bader, Deviance Management, published in 2019 by University of California Press. Dr. Joseph O. Baker is an associate professor of sociology at East Tennessee State University. He's a sociologist of religion and deviance. He's published research on a wide range of topics, including but not limited to intensive religious experiences, different types of secularity, such as atheism, congregational dynamics, paranormal subcultures, public views of science and religion, Christian nationalism, and penal populism. He's a senior research associate for the Association of Religious Data Archives and the editor-elect of the journal Sociology of Religion. His two latest books outline a theory of how people cope with being labeled as socially deviant and demonstrate the consequences of social fears among the American public. Joseph, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So I wonder if you'd begin the interview by saying just a few words about yourself.
Sure. So I am a sociologist of religion, and I also do work on the sociology of deviance in criminology. My background is that I finished my PhD in 2010 at Baylor University and started working here at East Tennessee State that same year. I have an interest in a lot of different things, but my main training is in the study of religion, and then also in this wider area of the sociology of deviance, which is a much kind of broader take on the idea of deviance than what you typically find in criminology, which is confined to crime. In this book, we're actually kind of trying to revive the sociology of deviance, which used to be quite vibrant, but has kind of become less popular since criminology has become more prominent. And so this is in some ways an effort to kind of revive interest in the idea of deviance as a wider concept.
Yeah, sure, sure. So what initially led you to write this book, and how did you sort of start this project with Christopher Bader?
So this is a very long project. It took us about a decade to put everything together for what would become this book. But in 2008, we were finishing field work for a book called Paranormal America. And so as part of that, we had spent a lot of time with paranormal subcultures. So UFO groups or Bigfoot groups or ghost hunters. And as part of this, in particular, we'd noticed these different ways that different groups and people would respond to being labeled as deviant. Because the paranormal, even though it's pretty popular in the sense that a lot of people believe in it, still is stigmatized in the sense that, you know, if you go to your job and tell people you think you've been abducted by aliens, it's going to bring some stigma. So we'd seen different ways people respond to this potential stigma. And you can do it in a bunch of different ways. You can try to hide your belief in it, or you can try to convince people that actually it's not that weird. Or you can just say, you know what, I don't really care what other people think of me. I believe this, and that's just how it is. And so we've seen all these different responses to being stigmatized. And we thought there was a more general principle there but we couldn't really cover it in Paranormal America because the point of that book was to give sort of a survey overview of different paranormal subcultures and belief in the United States. And so we couldn't really go down this separate path of outlining a theory of why people respond in different ways. But we also thought it was a very interesting idea. And so essentially, we kind of had this idea that grew out of this previous project, and we wanted to pursue it as its own end. And so it kind of started there. And from there, we tried to start work first on developing the idea, and then how would we apply it, and how would we go about it. And so it kind of came from it came out of that previous project, and we thought there was enough there to do a whole book on it.
Yeah, and it's definitely like a very thorough book. Like, I especially enjoyed the first couple of chapters and really laying out this theory of deviance. So can you tell us a little bit about your methods?
Yeah, sure. First of all, I'm thrilled that you thought the theory chapters were okay. You always worry about putting a theory chapter in there and whether or not it's going to drive people away. We tried to make it so that it was engaging and interesting, but it's always a bit of a risk. So the way we lay this out is we kind of set up the theory in the first few chapters.
Yeah.
And then we apply them to some case studies. And for the methods part, we really had as a very explicit goal for this book that we wanted it to be as well-rounded as possible and to use as many different methods as we could reasonably and feasibly apply. Chris and I both do a lot of survey research. And so, you know, we're quantitative sociologists in some ways. And so that's always part of what we do. But we also both enjoy field work and qualitative analysis. And we always kind of feel like it's hard to tell a story with just numbers. You've got to get in there and talk to people and see what they're doing and see what lived experience is like. And then there's also the other aspect of qualitative research that we brought to this, which was we want to see how things are framed in the public sphere. So essentially, we ended up combining five different methods in this. So we do some surveys because, again, we're survey researchers. So we did some subcultural surveys of groups. So when we spent time with these Bigfoot subcultures, we surveyed people who participated in these groups or went to conferences about Bigfoot. We surveyed UFO conferences, people who get together for those types of subcultures. We also used some national surveys from Pew. And those were of people who identify as sexual minorities, LGBT and or Q. And so there we're looking at kind of a wider look at surveys. So we kind of have primary surveys and we also have secondary surveys we use. We do use some field work in this. As I mentioned, the whole idea of this grew out of ethnographic field work with paranormal subcultures. So we do draw on that. We actually conducted more ethnographic field work with new paranormal subcultures for this book. We still draw on some of those ones we had done previously. We use interviews. One of the more interesting groups we studied was the Westboro Baptist Church, who is kind of infamous for protesting soldiers' funerals. And we visited them on a couple of occasions. We attended their church services. We went to their protests. We also did in-depth interviews with 20 members of the group. So we used those interviews. We used secondary interviews for a case of what we call an outsider case study of Matilda Bernstein Sycamore, who is a self-identified queer activist. And so she kind of advocates for LGBT rights. But she does so from kind of an outsider perspective. And so we use lots of different interviews she'd done, and we kind of compiled those. We do some content analysis. So one of the things we look at is normalization movements. And one of those we were interested in is the successful effort to repeal prohibition in the late 1920s and 1930s. And to look at how that was framed in public discourse, we did content analysis of 150 New York Times articles, kind of look at that. And then the last method we use is policy analysis. So we look at that historical case study of alcohol repeal of alcohol prohibition, and we compare it and sort of make it line it up with contemporary movements to normalize cannabis use, both medical and recreational. And for that, we did some policy analysis where we're looking at which states are more or less likely to adopt particular policies about cannabis. So I know that that sounds like a lot. It is a lot, part of why it took us a decade to do this. But the whole idea was we want to sort of probe this theory from as many different angles as possible to try to develop the most well-rounded assessment of what we're doing.
Yeah, and I certainly got that from the theory chapter. As I mentioned, it was so well done in terms of how you laid it out. And as someone who's not super familiar with theory of deviance and that sort of thing, like, I really got a good grasp on the theory of deviance. So first, for those also who maybe aren't as familiar with deviance and that field of sociology, can you first define deviant and make, well, what makes someone or something deviant?
Sure. We would say it's beliefs, behaviors, or conditions that, if discovered, would incur a negative social reaction and cause stigma. So there's a few different ways that people try to define what is deviant. Two of the most central ones are what we call a normative definition, which it says it's something that breaks social norms. And then a more constructivist take has been what's called the reactivist position, which says deviance is essentially negative social reaction. And that one's important because it puts the emphasis on response, which is a critical sort of perspective to take, and it's important to do that. We also wanted to, we amend that definition a little bit, though, because we think hidden deviance is still important in the sense that even if you're not caught doing something and you don't actually incur negative social sanction, if someone anticipates it and then hides accordingly, that still affects their behavior and identity. So we kind of take that reactivist definition and we add that subset to say that it's something that, if discovered, would have that negative social sanction. And it's important to say, we are not trying to say that in saying things are deviant, we're not ourselves labeling these deviant. We just go by what society does or what a social group does. So deviance is totally context dependent. It changes across time and places and cultures. And it's really just about whether there's negative social sanction on something. And so we kind of let the groups we study, in a sense, and how people respond to them define what is deviant or not, and then we go from there.
Sure, sure. So in the subtitle of the book, you call, you mentioned insiders, outsiders, hiders, and drifters. Can you briefly explain the processes of deviance management that you go over in the book?
Yeah, so those four different titles are kind of the four basic responses to being labeled deviant that people may have. And I should say what we're trying to do here is the study of deviance has long done one of two things. It's asked this question of why do people do weird things or bad things or strange things? So it's asked this why question. Or it has looked at why certain behaviors, beliefs, or conditions get defined as deviant. So it's either looked at what causes deviance, so to speak, the etiology of deviance, or it looks at why are certain things defined as deviant. We didn't want to do either of those things. We instead are interested in this question of how, which is like, how do people respond to something that would either has already gotten them stigma or could get them stigma? And so we came at this from the perspective of, how do the individuals and communities who are labeled as deviant themselves respond to this negative social sanction? So our question is more, how do you respond? Which is something of, it's not that it's never been looked at, but I would say it's not been systematically and thoroughly explored. So that's the angle we try to take, in that insider, outsider, hider, and drifter are kind of like archetypes or ideal types of ways people may respond to being labeled deviant or potentially labeled deviant. So for each one of them, they're kind of like different responses to that circumstance. So insiders, this would be a response where if a person or a group has been labeled as deviant, they respond by trying to start a reform movement and trying to normalize the behavior or identity in question. So here you can think of, say, the movement for same-sex marriage, where the rhetoric there is, we're just like you. There's no difference between, you know, sort of mainstream society and us. This is a family just like other families. And mainstream society should stop stigmatizing us for something that's not deviant. And so there, what you're trying to do is reform society. You want to work through existing systems and you want to change them to accept something that previously has been stigmatized. So we call that insider. The idea is you're kind of working inside of existing social systems and you want to make some change. Okay, so that's one response you could have. Another response is what we call outsiders. And this is more typically what we think of with deviant subcultures. And this response is more of a, to hell with mainstream society. We don't care what you think of us. We're going to do our own thing, and we're going to sort of subset and subculture. So we're going to kind of create a space and a place where like-minded people can get together, and we won't stigmatize each other. And if mainstream society stigmatizes us, then so be it. So there the strategy is one of kind of separating from the thing that is stigmatizing you and creating this alternative culture that does not stigmatize. And that has many benefits in the sense of community. And it also comes with a high price in the sense that you pay a price with giving up mainstream social capital. All right. So another strategy, the hider strategy, is just what it sounds like. This goes back to the Irving Goffman idea of the difference between people who are discredited, that is, they're already stigmatized, and people who are discreditable, which means they have something that could stigmatize them, but it's not yet discovered. So here, the strategy is different. So unlike the other three strategies of deviance management, for hiders, the goal is information control. And so rather than addressing a stigma and figuring out how to deal with it, you're just trying to keep it from coming to the surface. So again, here, what you're trying to do is just avoid stigma by keeping something from being discovered. And the last one we call drifters. Here, the strategy on stigma management is to do a couple of things. First, you sort of limit your social contacts. So if people think bad of me, but I don't really allow them into my life and allow them to get close to me, then I'm hurt less by that. And so if I limit my social contacts and my participation in mainstream society, I can limit some of that stigma that I incur. And so here it's kind of like the strategy is one of withdrawal. You're kind of like pulling back from this and trying to avoid stigma in that way. So those four are kind of like our ideal types, modes of response to being labeled deviant or to potentially being labeled deviant. And then we kind of use these to understand how people react to different circumstances.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then you go into these cases that you review in the book, like the LGBTQ groups, like you said, the Westboro Baptist Church, and the Bigfoot subculture. So can you talk a bit about how you chose each case?
Sure. So the Westboro, who we open and close the book with, frankly, are just an absolutely fascinating religious group. And both Chris and I are people who study both religion and deviance, and you honestly couldn't find anything that fits that nexus better than this group. They're very clearly and fervently religious, and they're very clearly and vigorously deviant and proud to be so. So this is another thing that grew out of a previous project. One of Chris's previous books was on images of God, which is this study of how people think about God and how that affects their lives. And he used, as part of that book, he used Westboro as sort of a case study of angry God. So what Westboro is known for is protesting soldiers' funerals, but again, they'll protest anything. They protest other churches. They protest the Super Bowl. They protest anything and everything that will get them attention. And their message that they really want to deliver to people is that God hates you and you're going to hell. And so they're kind of known for that. And so Chris was using them as this archetype of angry God because they have a particularly angry image of God. So he did use it as part of his book, America's Four Gods. And so when they were done with that, they only used it for a very small sort of subsection in that book. And I had helped him do some interviews with that and visited the group. And I was just absolutely fascinated by who they are and why they do what they do. And so we thought there was a lot more to say about them, and especially from this perspective of deviants, because they are willfully and gleefully deviant. I mean, they love the fact that people despise them. It sort of brings them joy in some way. And so we wanted to kind of like probe into this idea of why are they responding to stigma in this way? And so they make this fascinating case study because they're right on this line between insider and outsider. Their message is one of outsiders because they don't even really expect people to convert. They don't care if you convert. They're just here to tell you that God hates you, which is not a message that wins a lot of favor. So the messaging strategy is decidedly that of outsiders. They're kind of like proud to be different. But they use insider, what we would call insider strategies. They refuse to break laws. They are very, very vigilant about observing laws. And so they actually become this perfect example of what we would say they're deviant, but not criminal. They're very clearly breaking social norms, willfully breaking social norms, but they will not break laws. And so it was this really interesting case study. And it, what happened is American states and the federal government changed laws. So they changed laws about funeral protests in response to this group, because they had this weird nexus of deviant but not criminal. So we use them as to kind of outline a couple of things. One is the complexities of how people may respond, communities may respond to being labeled deviant, because they're a pretty interesting and complicated group. But we also use them to sort of illustrate this idea of this insider-outsider dynamic, because they sort of toe the line between those two things. And so we thought the interest of the group and the complexity of the case made it important for us to use. So that's where that one came from. In terms of the LGBTQ community and subcultures, it's funny because the thing that Westboro really is protesting against more than anything is the acceptance of sexual minorities. So in some ways we liked sort of using this counter case to them. This is the thing they're protesting essentially. And sort of using it as a juxtaposition to that. But we chose that for a couple of reasons. One is that there's been rapid social change on this in the United States in the last 30 or 40 years. So if you look at, say, the general social survey and whether people think same-sex relationships are acceptable or wrong, that has dramatically changed. It used to be in like the late 1980s, about 80% of Americans would say that that's always wrong. And now we're down to, I believe it's in the low 30s% would say that that's wrong. So you have this rapid transformation of how people think about sexual minorities. So it's important in that sense. It's a important case of change. It's also important in sort of the moral sense that we understand how people respond to being labeled deviant in this way. And so we chose it for those reasons, just because it's an important issue to address. And also because in the sense of deviance management, this is something that has long been looked at. So you can think of the idea of being, you know, quote unquote, closeted and hiding and transitioning from that. And so it sort of fit this, the application of our ideas. So to look at that one, we did two things. We used survey data to look at how people who self-identify as sexual minorities have changed how they approach society over time. So we look at some data from the 1980s and we look at some contemporary data and see how things have changed. And we also use that case study of Matilda, who kind of takes this outsider stance. And so her thing is that she wants to be critical of mainstream society and the ways that it has stigmatized sexual minorities. And she is a fascinating speaker and a great writer. She's very compelling, makes great arguments. And so we had this nice case study of somebody who makes a very clear outsider critique. So that allowed us to kind of look at it from this one angle, sort of the outsider criticism angle. And then we could look at this survey data to look at how people respond in different ways. And then the last thing we wanted with that case study was to see who participates in normalization movements. So if you're looking at who gives money to LGBTQ causes, or who votes for certain candidates because they support sexual minority rights, who boycotts or supports businesses who do these things, we wanted to look at how these different sort of reactions to deviance might influence people's participation in social movements. And what we found there was really interesting, that people who take the insider stance, that normalization stance, do have significantly higher rates of participating in these reform movements. So reform movements kind of become the vehicle for insiders to try and change society. So it made for a really good case study on that level. So we picked that one because it was strategic in the sense it's important to our theory, but also for moral reasons in the sense that we think it's important to look at sexual minorities in a positive light and see how these different reactions to being stigmatized occur. And on a positive note, how the stigma has lessened over time. So that one was an important one for us to pick up. The Bigfoot one, again, this one kind of just grew out of, we already had done a lot of field work with these groups. And our original ideas for the whole book came from studying a couple of groups in particular, where you had an insider movement inside the Bigfoot world where they're trying to like convince science and scientists that actually this thing is should be mainstream and should be biological science. And then you have this outsider movement, we call it kind of the psychic Sasquatch approach, where they're like trying to communicate with nature spirits and claiming that Bigfoot has some connection to UFOs and all this sort of. So that these two approaches to this same topic couldn't be radically more different. And these two groups really, really dislike each other because they're taking this thing in very different directions. And so we had this insider-outsider dynamic that we first observed in that subculture. And so we kind of just wanted to draw that out here. So it was sort of a natural application on that. The last one, though, the comparison of the normalization of prohibition and the contemporary movement to normalize cannabis use, chose that one for a couple of reasons. One is its contemporary policy importance for the contemporary laws and change in laws. It's a very interesting sociological and political science question to say, under what circumstances do these laws change? And so that, again, the contemporary issue with that is, when do states normalize cannabis use? But to get insight into that, we wanted to look at what was a very successful normalization movement of a similar issue, which is the ingestion of, you know, psychoactive substances. And so we looked at prohibition repeal for that. And to be honest, I've long been very interested in prohibition repeal because there's quite a bit in history and even sociology and political science on prohibition enactment, but there's far less on repeal. And so in some sense, we know more about the conditions under which we expand the boundaries of deviance than we do about the conditions under which we retract them. And so here we took this as an example of a successful normalization strategy. Repeal of prohibition was a very successful normalization strategy. And the idea was, if we can look and see how they framed their issue, we can get insight into what strategies can lead to success in a normalization movement. And so once we kind of had that, the question was, well, how do we then go about looking for framing? And it turned out that the New York Times archives had just a trove of stories about this from the era in which it was occurring. And in particular, from this group, the Women's Organization for the for National Prohibition Reform, which was the primary group that successfully achieved normalization. So we had this large amount of public stories about how this group had tried to frame repeal. And so we used this as a case study of normalization movements. And also the leader of the WONPR, Pauline Sabin, was sort of an exemplar of this insider strategy and kind of trying to work inside the system to get what you want. And so we tried to use this as an example, sort of an exemplar of when a normalization strategy and movement can succeed, and kind of extrapolate out from that what strategies they used that were so successful.
Sure. Yeah. I really like each of these cases because you could really see like the practical, the theory, like in practice, and how like you had these theories of, okay, this is what an insider is, and then here's how we're going to apply it to a case. I'm very interested though, because you bring up stigma and how some of these groups, like the hiders, how did you gain access to these groups and your methods? Like, how did you gain access? How did you gain the trust of these organizations and rapport to be able to conduct research on the on these organizations?
Yeah, that's a great point. The hiders question is actually the most difficult thing to study, because there you were kind of confined to people who get caught, and then you can kind of look back at their stories. Or we have a handful of studies that were done, frankly, now are widely seen as unethical in their methods, but give us insight into hidden deviance. Tea room trade is the obvious example here, where Laud Humphreys studied people who hide participation in sexual subculture encounters of men who have sex with other men. And so a lot of times for the hiders, we're very limited in that. And so you almost have to rely on secondary data there, because imagine trying to get, you know, a study through an IRB where you're going to say, we're going to secretly watch people participating in hidden deviance. It just wouldn't happen. So unfortunately on the hiders, a lot of times we have two things. We have people who are open enough to report some things in an anonymous survey. So they're hiding in a sense that they wouldn't say it out loud, but they'll say it to an anonymous survey. So we can do it a little bit that way. But for true hiders, we're kind of confined to people who get caught, and also these studies that have previously been done that you probably couldn't do today. So hiders are the trickiest one, and we kind of had to rely on secondary research there a lot. For the others, the Bigfoot groups, they have varying levels of suspicion about people coming in and studying them. They certainly don't want to be, their thing is they don't want to be made light of and made fun of, which has happened to them many times. And so for them, essentially, once we were able to convince them that our interest was not in proving Bigfoot right or wrong, our interest was simply in sort of these other social dynamics. And once they accepted that that was what we were up to, and we weren't there to do an expose for a magazine or something, and they kind of got to know us, they were willing to allow us to do some research with them. And frankly, were very willing to participate, and ended up being, it should be said, great informants, great participants. And so there we did kind of have to win some trust. And this book is not possible without them being willing to do that. On the other field work, the Westboro group, their interest, their main thing is that they wanted public attention. And so once they realized, again, some similar thing, that we're just there to study what they're up to, they actually were very open to doing interviews. And they do interviews all the time with news organizations and things. So for those where we actually were trying to do field work, there was a process of gaining trust and those sorts of things that always come along with field work. But our participants were great, and they were really willing to kind of help us understand where they were coming from once they understood that we wanted to tell their story from their perspective.
Sure. Yeah. What was the most surprising part about your research? And sort of going off of that, what was the experience like of doing research in these groups? Because these are stigmatized groups that people perhaps have a lot of misconceptions about. So during the conducting of this research, did you find anything that was particularly surprising? And as well, what was your experience like going into these groups and meeting them and talking to them? What was that like?
Yeah, well, I mean, honestly, the surprising thing to us actually is what became the start of the book, which is that from the outside, and I feel comfortable saying this, but when you first hear about, a quote unquote deviant subculture, the assumption is that people inside that subculture are all the same. Because in some sense, that's what stigma does, is stereotypes. It says that all people who have a particular attribute here, they're all the same. So if we're thinking about Bigfoot hunters, the assumption is, well, all Bigfoot hunters, you know, they must all be the same. Once you get inside of any subculture, it's really readily apparent that there are very different factions inside of there. And often there's more conflict inside the group or inside of the subculture itself than there is between the subculture and the outside, or at least that's the way it seems inside. So when we started doing that field work with the different paranormal groups, we were just really interested in all these different sort of factions that occur inside of the subculture itself. And so that was part of our initial interest, was the assumption from the outside would be, well, they must all get along because they share this stigma in common. But that's not the case at all. They have very different ways they respond to being labeled as deviant, and those responses then create all this conflict. So that was sort of surprising initially, and it was interesting enough that we wanted to pursue it and kind of pull it apart and see what was going on there. So that was something that was surprising that we sort of decided to lean into and turn into kind of a research insight. In terms of doing the field work with these groups, I love doing field work because there's nothing like participant observation and being around people as they live their lives and go about things that they do. It just is such a richer and deeper form of information. Again, I'm a survey researcher, so I believe in surveys and doing quantitative analysis. But it's one thing to ask people if they believe in something or do something, and it's quite another to see how they go about doing it. So the actual doing of the field work, I always find fascinating. I mean, I'm a people watcher. That's why I'm a sociologist. So it's interesting to do those things. Something I do find fascinating is the way people respond to us studying groups that are stigmatized. We kind of get a bit of a courtesy stigma by virtue of doing this, especially the paranormal thing. People now sort of assume that I must really be into UFOs or something, and people are always bringing me weird stories and things, which I like. I mean, I find these things interesting. But there's kind of this double response people have. It's a mix of repulsion and fascination. It's kind of like people will step into your office and close the door behind them and want to talk about the latest Bigfoot sighting and whether or not I think it's real. And then I have to sort of explain to them, that's not really what we do. We're not here to, I'm not a wildlife biologist. I can't tell you whether it's real or not. We're there to sort of study these subcultural dynamics. So I find other people's response to us studying deviant groups to be, not as interesting as the deviant groups themselves, but there's a sociological dimension to that as well.
Yeah, for sure. It reminds me of this topic we hear about in sociology, research. And like, oh, are these people that are studying this group, like, are they a part of that group? Like, why are they studying them? So it's interesting that you get sort of this courtesy stigma. And similarly, going off of this idea of like researcher versus participant, I want to go back a little bit to some of the theory. Can you talk a little bit about role conflict and its relationship to deviance management?
Yeah, absolutely. So that is kind of the thing that leads to some of these different strategies, is this idea of role conflict. So by role conflict, we mean when you're holding two social statuses which have accompanying roles, these behavioral expectations with them that in some ways conflict. So we know a decent amount about this in some ways. So we can think about the conflict between being a parent and the expectations of your job, right? That's a form of role conflict. How do you resolve it? But being labeled deviant imposes a very acute form of role conflict. Now, different forms of deviance, depending on the degree to which something is stigmatized, are going to impose this more or less. But the idea is that you're going to lose some of your conventional social status or social capital if you are outed or publicly own something that is stigmatized. And so how do you deal with that role conflict? And this, in some ways, is this internal conflict that leads to these different behavioral strategies. So the insider strategy is to say, I'm going to meet this role conflict head on, and I'm going to go to the people or at least the representatives who sort of mainstream society who are stigmatizing me. I'm going to try to get in the mainstream media. I'm going to make the case for why this should not be something that is seen as stigmatizing or denigrating. And so I'm going to take this role conflict that's being imposed on me, and I'm going to meet it head on. Now, we can think about the example of sexual minorities and how this role conflict was far more acute when the repression was higher. So if we think about being gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, the 1970s or 80s, you know, you're liable to lose your job, all these different things that your investment in conventional society, you would have to give up to out yourself. And it takes very brave, courageous people, often from the strategy of what we call outsiders, to sort of come out first and be the ones who are willing to put it out there. As that stigma lessens over time, though, if it does, it allows far more people to meet that role conflict head on. And as that happens, there's kind of like you can meet a critical mass where enough people with enough conventional credentials are willing to out themselves that it does start to normalize. And so if you can get to a place where people can say, hey, look, you know, I'm just a conventional upstanding member of the community who happens to be gay, lesbian, or bisexual, or transgender, and I want to tell my story, then that helps lessen the stigma. And so the role conflict can be taken head on in that way. So the role conflict itself, again, can change depending on how much repression there is. But it's the role conflict itself and how do you deal with it that sort of leads to these different strategies. So like I said, the insider is one strategy, outsider is another, where you say, I'm gonna buy into this other, my sort of deviant subculture status, and I'm gonna, you know, sort of give my all to that status and let the other mainstream conventional status go. Or the hider strategy is the flip side of that, where I'm gonna invest in mainstream society and I'm gonna try to keep people from knowing that I have this other status. So they're all in some sense a reaction to this role conflict that sort of spurs different strategies of action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm interested in your take on, previously you mentioned how the Westboro Baptist Church is very deviant, but they're not criminals. Do you think this theory of deviance, and if so, how do you think it changes depending on whether or not the form of deviance is illegal or legal?
Yeah, I think so. That absolutely pushes, if you're thinking about the degree of repression, the degree of punishment, that pushes that degree of punishment way up. And so when things are illegal, it almost precludes insider strategy. Now, you can think about civil disobedience, nonviolent resistance. There are some ways you can break laws and try to maintain that insider status. But when it becomes illegal, that changes the dynamic in the sense that what it does is it cuts off insider strategies. And it will then take people who can successfully reduce the legal restrictions on something in order to allow a larger insider reform movement to occur. So the legality or illegality of something is a very important dividing line between whether or not reform movements are actually very possible or not. So in this sense, changes to law are kind of like the first step. So changes to law don't necessarily mean full normalization has occurred, but you can't get that big wider movement often unless you get changes to law that reduce some of the restrictions on its illegality. So, you know, crimes are a different animal altogether. And especially if, you know, we're thinking about things where they're at least morally debatable. There are no, you know, normalization movements, at least above ground, for more forms of crime where there's consensus about them. So there's not people who are trying to normalize spousal abuse or something like that. So things where there's consensus among people that these things are wrong, you typically, insiders is not something that can occur. For something that's more borderline but illegal, you need people who are going to be willing to sacrifice their, you know, put their lives on the line to try to normalize those things. Once the illegality is removed, then you have the possibility for a true reform movement.
Yeah, we're real. I imagine that we're really going to understand that more and more with this the legalization of cannabis across states. We'll be able to do more comparison in that realm. Go ahead.
Sorry, that was my computer.
No, there. You're fine. So going forward, how do you, like, what gaps in the research or what points do you think this research could be expanded in the future? And where should sociologists take the study of deviance moving forward?
Yeah, so, I mean, that was honestly the point we wanted to make at the end is the first thing is that we should be studying deviance as a topic and applying it to different things. So the sociology of deviance really kind of had its zenith in the 1960s and early 1970s when it was a vibrant field of study. Lots of people were doing all kinds of different studies from this perspective. And it has pretty much lost steam steadily since then as things that used to be studied from the perspective of deviance have become sort of bifurcated and splitted into different specialties. So criminology kind of took some of those studies away. The study of social movements became something where you look at reform movements or something, you kind of studied it from a social movements perspective. You think about sexuality and gender studies moving into some things that used to be studied from the perspective of deviance. So it used to be a really vibrant subfield in sociology, and it's kind of been sort of balkanized up into all these different pieces now. And people don't really approach it from that angle anymore. Now, we're not trying to say that people shouldn't be doing social movement studies. They absolutely should. People should obviously be doing gender and sexuality studies. But what we're saying is that thinking about things and whether they are condemned and stigmatized by different communities is an important aspect of looking at these different things. And it can give us insight into, say, like social movements, when reform movements succeed or fail and how they can succeed or fail. So it can give us insight into all these different areas that are important to sociologists. But this particular angle has been kind of lost, or it's been in some sense forgotten that it is a good way to think about it. So the first thing we want to do is just say we should revive interest in this. Because it can have this application across such a wide range of areas. So for instance, I'm a sociologist of religion. There's so many different ways that the strategies we outline, this insider, outsider, hider, is applicable to people who are religious minorities in places where that religion is stigmatized. So this is not to say we should replace the sociology of religion with deviance studies, but just that the study of deviance can inform all these other things that we're already doing. So that's one thing. The second thing is to say, we have to think about this as so much more than just crime. So the rise of criminology as a subfield has kind of led to this focus on things that are criminal and sort of exclusively criminal. But the idea of things that are stigmatized, the study of deviance is so much wider than just crime. So, you know, I'm happy for criminology to keep on focusing on crime, but there's so much more that we can look at that is deviant but not criminal. And so there's a lot to study, and there's a big wide range of behaviors and beliefs and conditions that would fit this criteria that are not the domain of criminology. So, for instance, thinking about those paranormal subcultures, criminology is not going to study those because it's not criminal. But that doesn't mean it's not sociologically meaningful or interesting. And so this is kind of a way to get into that. And the last thing, which we tried to sort of do by example here, was that we are all for mixed and multiple methods in this, because as you mentioned, some of these things are really hard to study. And so you have to do qualitative studies. Other things you can study with surveys or quantitative analysis, and we should. But I really hope that there's more acceptance for the use of mixed methods and that there's less hyper-specialization of methods. I don't see any reason not to be a methodological pluralist. They give us different forms of insight, and we should be using all of them in different ways to get at ideas from different angles.
Yeah, as someone who's also interested in mixed methods, I couldn't agree more. Well, Joseph, we've taken up a lot of your time. My final question for you is, what are you working on now or next?
So we have a book that it'll be coming out on March 3rd, 2020 here. It's called Fear Itself, The Causes and Consequences of Fear in America. And what this is bringing together a lot of different threads from some studies that we've been running, some surveys. So Chris Bader, again, is my co-author on this, along with Ed Day and Ann Gordon. They're all at Chapman University in California, and they have been running these studies, the Chapman Surveys of American Fear, for the last, we now have 6 years of data on this, but the book covers 2014 to 2018. Notably, those turned out to be very important years to study social fear in America. I don't think we had it in mind when we started those surveys or doing this book that we were going to be kind of putting our finger on the pulse of something that would be so politically important, but that is sort of how it turned out. So inside of this, we look at these different aspects of fear. Some of them are kind of traditional psychological phobias and things, but the larger emphasis is on social fears. So we look at xenophobia, Islamophobia, conspiracy theories as an aspect of fear and a response to fear, fears about crime and terrorism, other things like fears about environmental degradation and global climate change. And so we kind of look at how two things. One is who holds these different types of fears? What are the patterns of these fears? What are the sociological dimensions of these fears? But the second sort of consequential follow-up is, what are the personal and political consequences of fear? So if you have an intense fear of an immigrant invasion, you know, how does that affect how you think about the world politically? Obviously, there are very clear implications for that. And so what the book does is compile these different topics across all these surveys. We, again, are mixing in some field work here to give some narrative illustration to some of these dimensions. So field work with like conspiracy theory subcultures and things like that. It's a book that kind of looks at fear from a sociological perspective, which has been done a little bit, but it's been done much more from the perspective of psychology. And so we're kind of looking at fear as a social emotion and looking at its political consequences.
That sounds like a really great project. And like you said, very relevant for this time that we're in right now. We'd love to have you back on the show eventually to talk about that book too.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds really great. Where can listeners find you online to learn more about your work and your book? Are you on social media?
Yeah, you can. I'm on Twitter and I'm at my handle on there is Paradox of Belief. So you can find me there. And then all of my research and work, you can find me, since I'm at East Tennessee State, you can find links to all my research through that. So those are the main places to find me.
Great. Again, this has been an interview with Dr. Joseph Baker, co-author of Deviance Management, Insiders, Outsiders, Hiders, and Drifters, published by University of California Press, with Christopher Bader. Joseph, I want to thank you again for being on the show today. I really enjoyed chatting with you.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.